I downloaded a brass band playing an ABBA medley over the weekend.
Of course you
did. For reasons.
You don't need to give me a reason.
The CMU podcast, in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Paul McCartney, Donald Trump, and videos on Facebook. It's the CMU podcast, looking back at the last week in the music industry. I am Andy Maltz. He is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris Cook.
You know how on last week's podcast...
Say hello.
We talked about how there's now a smaller table in the studio.
Yes, but you haven't said hello. I said hello to you.
I like that.
Say hello.
I liked that last week because it means there's more room in the studio.
Mm.
But this week you've come to the podcast recording with germs. You're infected, you told me this morning. And now I'm closer to you.
I have a very mild sore throat. In the end, it's the end of a sore throat. You're not going to...
And I can already feel a sort of a sniffle coming on now that I've sat this close to you, because I'm at least, I would say, 5.5 inches closer to you with the new table than I was with the old table. So this could be the podcast where, you know, I get the disease and
die.
Look,
this pop shield is going to be, that's going to be absorbing all of it. Whoever uses this next is in trouble.
All right, then. I'm feeling good now. So it's not me who's going to be incredibly ill.
Catching all of it.
It's whoever comes into this studio next to record a voiceover. Oh, well, as long as it's not me that's going to die as a result of this podcast recording, I'm fine with that.
I don't think anyone's going to die.
Right.
Anyway, you didn't say hello. Say hello.
Hello.
Hello. What have you been up to this week, Chris Cook?
It's been a very busy week. You know how last week I was talking about how I'd had a very lazy week?
Yes.
Including some post-CMU daily napping.
Yes.
That was last week.
Unbelievable.
Not this week. This week has been a very busy week. We announced the topics that will be explored at the 4 conferences that we present as part of The Great Escape in Brighton each May.
Yeah.
CMU Insights at The Great Escape. It's the core content within the convention side of The Great Escape, and it's basically 4 conferences in one. We've done it that way for about 2-3 years now.
Yes,
this is
we
the
have.
Third time.
Yeah.
Third time that we've basically presented 4 conferences in one. This is the first time we've come up with the slogan, 4 conferences in one.
Yes.
And
I think we've been telling people that for a while, but just us personally telling people that rather than it being part of the branding.
Exactly. And when you say a while, you mean in the last couple of months rather than ahead of the 2015-2016 Great Escape.
I'm pretty sure we were telling people that around last year's conference.
But now we're saying 4 conferences in one.
Yeah.
What I noticed is 2 or 3 people, when that announcement went out in the CMU Daily yesterday, then got back to me and said, oh, that's really good how you've changed it to this 4 conferences. It's like we've not changed anything. We've just found a better way of saying it. So basically, over 2 days in 2 venues in the middle of May, alongside the Great Escape Showcase Festival, we are presenting 4 conferences, one focused on export, one focused on royalties, one focused on media, and one focused on drugs.
Correct.
So that will be good. And if you're thinking that out of those 4, the royalties conference sounds the dullest...
It's got the sweariest tagline.
We've given it a sweary tagline so that people don't go, oh, media, that sounds exciting. Export, interested in going global. Or drugs, that's really interesting. Or royalties. So each of them have a strapline. And because what I always say is when you talk about copyright and royalties, sometimes people say, oh, that's boring. Who wants to talk about copyright and royalties? But if you're an artist or a songwriter, and you're writing songs and you're recording music, copyright and royalties equals cash.
Yeah.
So basically, it could be called the money conference. Actually, perhaps that's what we should have called. It's too late now. We've announced, we've done the logos, we can't change it. So it's the royalties conference. Strapline.
Where's my fucking money?
So there, we've got money in the strapline. So Basically, it's a day about all the money being generated by selling CDs and downloads and through the streaming services and through sync deals and from radio and public performance and also the money created by songs when they're actually performed live. All of that. What happens to that cash as it goes from the radio station or the streaming service or the retailer or whatever through the system to artists and songwriters? And how does the money get split? And crucially, where does the money get blocked? There are lots of blockages in the system because of bad data, and there's certain business partners who are possibly taking more money than they deserve. In some cases, there'll be business partners taking more than they're contractually due. And so these are all the things we're going to explore during that whole day on money. Plus, we've got the Strand looking at music media and export. So taking your bands global, there'll be a bit of Brexit in that. What impact is bloody Brexit going to have on the UK music industry, but also the European music industry? We talk a lot about what will happen here. But when it comes to something like the copyright regime, All the copyright systems in Europe are linked through European law. We know there's a copyright review ongoing as we speak. There'll be a new European copyright directive probably this year, if not very early next year. But whenever there have been copyright conversations in Europe, that's one of the issues where actually the UK has really punched above its weight. Whenever there's a copyright conversation in Europe, the UK goes and presents a very specific viewpoint on intellectual property, which arguably, once the UK is no longer at the table, if that means particularly the French and the German governments have a weightier voice, French and German copyright law is very different to English copyright law. So it could be that when we exit the European Union, that has an impact on copyright for the rest of Europe. And these are all the sorts of things we'll be discussing as part of the export strand at the Great Escape.
And then finally, our fourth topic, following on from last year's mental health conference, we're going to be looking at drugs and addiction in the music industry.
Yeah, so that day will be split into two. So actually the first half will be following the Fabric debacle, although obviously the Fabric debacle had a happy ending, so that's good. But basically looking at licensing issues around clubbing and around festivals and some of the initiatives that have been introduced at certain venues and at certain festivals to ensure that, well, I suppose it's that thing, isn't it, that the law will say, well, we'll stop people from dying from drug overdoses at music events by just stopping drug taking.
Yeah.
But then there are other people that say, well, good luck with that. So rather than making a completely unrealistic statement, instead of that, what can we actually be doing in terms of education, in terms of on-site health, in terms of, you know, persuading people about what they should and shouldn't do without making unrealistic draconian demands? So that's the first half of that session. But then, as you said, the second half will basically continue the conversation that you led at last year's Great Escape on mental health within the music industry and how the music industry can better support its artists and the people who work behind the scenes, but specifically looking at this from the issues around addiction. Because actually, once that mental health conversation was kickstarted last year, and it does feel, I mean, we were piggybacking on momentum that was already occurring, but yeah, it does feel like that has been a much bigger topic of conversation since last year's Great Escape. And a number of people have said to me in the music community, often addiction and mental health go very closely together, and therefore we need to be tackling one in order to be fully supporting artists on the other. And so that's something we'll be looking at in more detail on the drugs conference.
There's one more thing Great Escape related that we announced this week that we should mention too, and that is a new training scheme for first-time speakers. So we can get more people who haven't spoken at conferences before but have something interesting to say involved.
So I am currently selecting the speakers who are going to speak on each of these four topics. So what we announced this week was simply the themes. We'll have another announcement going out in mid-February where we announce the initial speakers, and then another in March where we basically announce everybody else. So there are still lots of slots to speak on all of these topics. And what we're really keen to do this year is to have lots of people who have never spoken at a conference before, so we get new perspectives and new insights. There are lots of music conferences around the world, and sometimes you go to conferences and actually the people on stage are the people that you saw at the conference somewhere else in the world a few months ago, sort of talking about the same thing and therefore sort of saying the same things.
I mean, so there are reasons for that, aren't there? I mean, one of the reasons is that there are some people who are just very outspoken on certain topics, and so they get known as the person who speaks about that topic. And sometimes it's actually just that, you know, conference programmers go to other conferences and they see someone who's good at speaking, or should have them for mine. But then there's 15 other conference programmers there all thinking the same thing. I mean, we've got a fairly good record for getting new speakers in, but we really want to get more people in for this year who haven't spoken at a conference before.
And the reason why we've got this little new training program as part of this is sometimes I'll have conversations with people around about this time of year, and at the end of the conversation it'll be like, this was a really interesting conversation. Will you come on stage at the Great Escape in May and we'll have this conversation? Basically, the exact conversation we've just had. But we should have it in front of a room full of people. And then some people, understandably, are like, oh, I don't really want to do that. I've never done much public speaking. I'll just be really nervous. And so we want to offer a little bit of training and coaching to help those people prepare. And sometimes that's just working out what they're going to say, or it's just having a practice run so that they can then be as confident as possible when they get on stage. And also, hopefully, that will persuade a few people who sort of like the idea of getting on stage, or who have something they really want to say but have never done it before because they're too nervous about getting on stage. So
in which case, if you're a person who has never spoken at a conference before, but has, you think, probably something interesting to say about music export or royalties or the music media or drugs, where do they get in touch?
Or if you know someone.
Or if you know someone, which is probably more likely.
Yeah,
then, not that I'm saying that you, the listener, haven't got something interesting to say. I'm saying that...
I mean, that is what you're saying.
No, I'm saying the people that we're trying to reach are the people who have something interesting to say, but don't necessarily think of themselves as being that person who
you might sit on stage. You might sit across somebody at the office.
You may know someone, yeah, who you think that person's got a lot to say on this subject, but they're not thinking of themselves in that light. So put them forward or get them to put themselves forward.
So if you go to cmuinsights.com, massive Great Escape logo on the homepage, that will take you to the Great Escape page on our website. And there, all the information is there. And you click a button and it takes you to a form. Fill it out, won't take very long. I don't think we set an official deadline, but basically I'm going to start selecting those speakers in early Feb. So if you can do it as soon as you can, and we'll start going through those. And even if you haven't really got much to contribute to our conferences on export royalties, media and drugs, but there is another music business topic that you think you really could contribute, let us know anyway. We're not going to book you for the Great Escape because we haven't got anywhere to put you. However, as you know, we do these events all year round. We present sessions at other conferences around the world. We have the CMU DIY events that we do on a regular basis. And so we're trying to build a little directory of people who have interesting things to say about certain topics who we can get on stage for the first time. So even if what you want to talk about isn't relevant to those four topics, you won't be able to speak at the Great Escape this year, but you might be able to speak at another CMU Insights event. So fill out the form anyway, and we will be in touch.
So that's what's happening in the medium term. But right now, we've got a podcast to do, and I should tell you what we're going to talk about.
I thought you were going to suggest what we're going to be doing in the long term then.
No, I have no idea.
Where are we heading? Where are we going? What is the point of all of this?
I don't think we've got enough time to discuss
all right, then.
That broad topic.
You can go back to short term then.
We could abandon all the things I've written notes for and just talk about that if you want.
I've just come prepared to talk about evolutionary science and the latest developments in that field of academic research, but...
Well, I'll read the next bit of the notes and let's see...
If that comes up,
yeah. So coming up this week, we'll be looking at some of the enormous number of music-related Donald Trump stories from the last week. We'll be answering another of your questions, this time about the value of videos on Facebook. But first, Paul McCartney, Macca, the P-Man.
I'm interested in what other nicknames P-Mac. You've got for Paul McCartney. Sir Paul McCartney.
Sir Paul McCartney.
We don't normally...
Sir Macca. Smack.
It's CMU editorial policy.
Spumac.
Not to give people their titles, isn't it? If they're made-up titles.
Well, all titles are made up.
Well, if you're a doctor, if you've earned your title...
Oh, I see.
If you...
Well, arguably, Paul McCartney was given his knighthood for a reason and therefore has earned it.
I would disagree with that. So we're not interested in people's knighthoods, so we don't... although I think we ran a quote from Sony ATV...
We left it into the quote, yeah.
Relating to this story, we didn't feel that our editorial policy was so strong that we should remove his knighthood from the quote from Sony ATV. But there you go. So yeah, Paul McCartney's in the news.
Yeah, not for the reasons we've just discussed. There's not in any doubt that he is a knight. What is in doubt is the ownership of his song rights.
And in particular, his stake in the Lennon and McCartney catalogue. That is quite a famous catalogue of songs.
I think it's... people will probably... if you listen to a podcast like this, you've probably heard of Lennon and McCartney, I think.
And which, needless to say...
I would say 90% of our listeners will know who that is.
All these years... who doesn't? Can you get me a list of all the listeners who are not aware of the Lennon and McCartney songwriting
project? Right in if you haven't heard of them.
And we'll explain... next week we'll explain who Lennon and McCartney are. Just in case there's any...
one of them's a knight.
Any doubt, and the other's dead. So there you go. The Lennon and McCartney catalogue is still very valuable.
What are we even talking about?
I don't know. Famously, Sony ATV control the Lennon and McCartney catalogue. I say famously because obviously there's the backstory there that the song rights in the songs that Lennon and McCartney wrote for the Beatles back in the day ended up being owned by a publishing company called Northern Songs that then was acquired by ATV, which was a... I always think it's funny when we talk about ATV as this big music publishing company. It was like the ITV for East Anglia back in the day that for some reason set up a music publishing company. I think ATV made The Muppet Show. Perhaps they set up their music publishing company to publish all the Muppets' many songs. So ATV was a TV company. They set up a publishing company. They acquired Northern Songs, and in doing so, acquired the Beatles catalogue. And then in the 1980s, they decided that they were going to sell their publishing company, so they sold ATV. And then this is where the urban legend bit comes in. I think some of this has been confirmed as true, although it's sometimes exaggerated, which is, you might remember in the early 80s, Paul McCartney and Michael Jackson collaborated on a couple of songs. I wouldn't blame you if you've blocked that out of your brain.
I've got one of them playing in my head right now.
As we said, for two people who've produced a lot of great pop music over the years, when they came together, they were some pretty awful songs.
Some people just don't work well together.
So they collaborated together. Obviously, Paul McCartney was quite a bit older than Michael Jackson.
Side by side on my piano.
Now it's in everyone else's head. Well done.
So it just fell out.
So the story goes that Michael Jackson's career, his solo career, was just exploding. And Paul McCartney said to him in the studio, oh, now you're making lots of money. Do you know what would be a wise investment? A wise investment would be to invest in publishing, in songs. If you buy song rights, that's a really sound investment. You'll continue to make lots of money for the foreseeable future. And Michael Jackson said, yeah, that's a great idea. And then went away and bought ATV, which happened to be on the block at the time. And in doing so, got control of all of Paul McCartney's most famous songs. And then the story was that they fell out over that. Part of the urban legend is that they ended up in a price war. That bit's not true. McCartney wasn't bidding for it. But anyway, Michael Jackson ended up owning the Lennon-McCartney catalogue. He then merged his publishing company with Sony to create Sony ATV in the 90s, I think. And of course, last year, Sony bought the Michael Jackson estate out of that business. So Sony ATV is now a wholly owned subsidiary of Sony Corp.
Yes, well, that's a succinct history of that. But the reason we're talking about this now, there's a reversion right in American copyright law which allows a songwriter to take back their rights from their publisher, who they've assigned those rights to, after 35 years. And Paul McCartney is in the process of reclaiming those rights. He's written the letters to get that done, and he's sent them off to Sony ATV. And his problem is that Sony ATV hasn't indicated either way what it plans to do about that, whether it's just going to go, fair enough, your 35 years are up, have your rights back, or whether they're going to block them. So Paul McCartney, Macca the P-Man, has sued over this.
To get some clarification.
Yeah, because this all relates to a thing we discussed on the podcast last year, which is Duran Duran attempting to do exactly what Paul McCartney is doing.
Yes, so this is why hopefully we don't have to go into too much detail on the old reversion right, or everyone else is calling it a termination right. I prefer reversion rights. I'm going to stick with it and refer to it as the reversion right, which, as you say, comes from a bit of late 1970s American copyright law. It's 35 years after a contract. So if you assign, so transfer ownership in the copyright in a song that you've written to a publisher in America, this doesn't apply outside of the US, which is highly relevant here, but in America, after 35 years, you have the right to get your rights back. So you either terminate the contract or there's a reversion of the rights back to the songwriter. Although it's worth mentioning that when this was passed in 1978, a slightly different rule applied to works that were already published and assigned by 1978. Because you might be thinking, hang on a second, the Lennon and McCartney songs were written a lot longer than 35 years ago. Why is this only coming up now? But it was because older works, actually it was a longer period of time that had to pass. So all of this has only really come to a head in the last 5 years. And there's a process that songwriters have to go through, as you say, write a letter, fill out a form, in order to begin the termination, the reversion process. And McCartney has been doing that. But the reason why there are all these questions around the reversion right, and this isn't the only question, there are some other technicalities in American law that we still haven't quite worked out. One of the big ones is whether or not this reversion right should apply to recordings as well as songs. That's not to talk about today. But that's one of the debates, and all these debates are ongoing and need to be tested in the courts. But what is relevant here, and the Duran Duran case was the big test case on this last year, is what if you are a British songwriter like Paul McCartney or Simon Le Bon or Nick Rhodes? So you're a British songwriter. You assigned your rights to a British music publisher through a contract written under English law. Do you have the reversion right? Because reversion rights in American copyright law, remember, not in English copyright law. So what does that mean? And there has sort of been an assumption in the songwriting community, or perhaps it was wishful thinking, I don't know, that, okay, the reversion right doesn't exist in English copyright law. However, it does in American copyright law. So the global rights aren't going to terminate after 35 years, but the rights just in America should. So if you are a British songwriter, you should have the rights within the American market to say, okay, you still have my rights for the rest of the world, but I'm going to terminate and revert just in the US, so I will get all the royalties from the American market. And obviously the American is the biggest music market, so that's definitely worth having. And so various British songwriters have been filing the paperwork, hoping to get their rights back in the US. But Duran Duran was the big test case, because when Duran Duran did that, now they were actually signed to some little publishing company everyone had forgotten existed, but that had been bought by EMI Music Publishing at some point in its history, which in turn is now half-owned and controlled by Sony ATV, so in essence, it's a Sony ATV subsidiary. And when Duran Duran tried to exercise their reversion rights, the publisher said, no, you can't. Under the terms of your publishing contract, which is under English contract law, you can't revert. You don't have the termination right. And of course, Duran Duran took that to court, and Sony won.
Yeah.
We talked about on the podcast
last
year.
Went all the way to the High Court, and then they lost, which they found rather upsetting.
Now,
and that case is still pending an appeal.
Yes.
Which is where Paul McCartney comes in.
Indeed. We assume they're going to appeal. I don't think we've had confirmation on that yet, but I'm sure they will. Meanwhile, Paul McCartney has been filing the paperwork for these reversion rights for a number of years now. And as you say, it's not that Sony ATV have said to him, as they did to Duran Duran, it's not that they've said, no, you don't have a reversion right. We're ignoring these papers. We're going to keep control of your rights. And if you try and do a different deal with somebody else around them, well, we'll sue you for breach of contract. That's not what's happening. It's merely that what Sony ATV seemingly won't tell Paul McCartney and his people is, yeah, we've got the paperwork, we're fine with it, we'll just go through the bureaucracy, and at some point in the next few years, all of this will revert back to you within the US market. They won't confirm that. And what McCartney's lawyers seem to be saying, in fact, they explicitly say this in the lawsuit, is they feel that basically Sony ATV are playing for time to see what happens in this Duran Duran case.
Yeah.
They reckon it's going to go to appeals, so there's going to be some other stages, but they don't want to say to Macca right now, yeah, have your rights, because let's say this went all the way to Supreme Court in the UK, and that's going to take a couple of years, maybe longer than that. But if ultimately in the UK, the conclusion is you don't have a reversion right under a sort of standard English publishing contract of the 1980s or before that, then they might then turn around and say, well, it's unlikely that they're going to say screw you to McCartney. But I think what most publishers hope when this reversion right kicks in, well, with lesser known songwriters and less valuable catalogues, the songwriter can just take it away. What they would rather do is say, all right, then you've got a reversion right. Let's negotiate a new deal. Continue to work with us. These are all the reasons why you should, but we'll give you a better deal. And I suppose if it looked like actually there were huge questions over McCartney's reversion right through the English courts, then that would strengthen Sony's negotiating hand if they were to negotiate a new deal, because McCartney would be, well, either I do this deal or I fight this through the English courts and I might lose. So that's sort of the allegation that is being made. Sony ATV in their statement basically said, we love Paul McCartney. Isn't Paul McCartney great? Yeah, Paul McCartney. And then the last sentence actually dealt with the lawsuit. And they said...
They said it was unnecessary and premature.
So they seem a bit unhappy that these debates were ongoing behind the scenes, and why have they now taken it to court? If it does go to court, I suspect that it won't, but if it does, it will be interesting, because obviously this lawsuit is in New York. It's in the US rather than in the UK.
Yes.
So it would be brilliant. Well, it wouldn't be brilliant. It would be chaos. It would be brilliant from our perspective as people looking in from the outside. If McCartney pursued it in the New York courts and they said, yes, you have a reversion right in the US, and then Duran Duran case goes all the Supreme Court in the UK, and UK courts say, nope, you don't, not under English contract law, and then you've sort of got English contract law and American copyright law sort of in conflict, and that's sort of, well, it's good for law student dissertations. Because it's an interesting legal quandary.
But maybe not so good for Sir Macca.
And indeed, we know on the grapevine a lot of British songwriters from the 1980s, whose 35 years from their original publishing contracts are coming up. Bearing in mind, I mean, these days when sort of new artists do publishing deals, actually it's quite common there's a reversion right built into the contract. They don't necessarily assign the copyright to the publisher for the entirety of the copyright, what we would call life of copyright. But back in the 80s, that was sort of the norm. If you did a publishing deal, in return for your advance, you are basically giving the publisher control of the copyright. Obviously, they share the money with you. And under a publishing deal, they'll be giving you the majority of the money. But they have that stake in the copyright for life of copyright. So that's basically Paul McCartney's life and then another 70 years. So there were quite a lot of songwriters who were planning on filing this paperwork. And I assume there's a deadline on that. When the 35 years is up, certainly there's an earliest possible date that you can file that paperwork. I assume there's a latest possible date you're going to file that paperwork. And if you miss it, then it's assumed that the publisher continues to have it. I don't know. I must look that up. But there'll be lots of songwriters who are planning on filing the paperwork to get their rights back who will now be thinking, oh, is it even worse hiring a lawyer to fill out those forms if it's going to turn out I don't even have that right?
Well, if Duran Duran have lost one lawsuit and Paul McCartney may or may not lose another, that puts you in a shakier situation.
So the point is, and indeed Nick Rhodes in his statement after losing in the High Court last year said this, is that there are actually a lot of songwriters who are watching all of this with a lot of interest, as will we.
Yes, we will. And I'm sure that we will return to this later on, and I'll have a think about some more nicknames for Paul McCartney.
For the Mac Man.
That's one, yeah.
Yeah.
Still to come, some of this week's other stories in brief, and your questions. But now, Donald Trump, who, unless something fairly drastic happens in the next 24 hours after we record this podcast, it's about to become the President of the United States of America, like for actual real.
And unless you are tuning into this podcast as soon as it goes live, probably already is.
Yeah.
So welcome to the era of Trump. We're here. We've made it.
That sounded a bit like there's that Fall song, Dr. Buck's Letter. He ends up reading out an article about Pete Tong. Ends. I was in the realm of the essence of Tong. That's what
it sounded like. I think it did. But anyway.
It did. The era of Trump. The era of Trump. Let's let that sink in. The era of Trump. We're already in the era of Trump, really, because as we were discussing before this podcast.
Over lunch.
Donald Trump is already the US president we have reported on more than any other. And he's not yet US president at this point. I mean, I think that's probably true for most news organisations.
Perhaps once he's president and he discovers actually it's quite a boring job, then we'll all get bored too.
Oh, do you think he'll stick out 4 years? He did the whole campaign. I think that surprised a lot of people. So maybe he has got the staying power. He'll be really good.
I think his supporters will tell you he'll stick out all 8 years.
Yeah, we'll see.
We'll see.
But he's been in the music news this week. He's been in the music news for his entire campaign because he's had a habit of pissing off musicians throughout. And the story that's built up since he was elected was, of course, who will he get to perform at his inauguration ceremony and various inauguration galas, of which there are many.
Yeah, it's another thing you were saying over lunch. I mean, prior to this story being in the music news, neither of us ever realised in our system, you have a general election and then basically there's a prime minister immediately, or there was that one time with the coalition. But I mean, it took a few days and then basically they are prime minister and then everything carries on. Whereas I suppose in America, you have the election and then a build up and then there is a day where the new president takes over. But we never realised what a big day that was for the American people. And you were saying in Washington alone, aside from the official stuff that happens, so the official event and the official after party, just in Washington alone, there's a ridiculous number.
A huge number, because there's the official inauguration party, which is sort of a big public event, free ticketed, and you apply for tickets and you can go, and that's nice. But there's also various other sort of parties for the sort of people who own tuxedos. But there's more than one. I mean, there's several official parties. I was reading earlier like various articles detailing which parties Trump will actually go to, because he won't be able to go to all of the official parties. So him and Mike Pence are splitting them. But then there's all the unofficial ones. There's loads of those. Any political organisation basically has its own inauguration gala.
And then beyond Washington,
and beyond Washington,
elsewhere.
They're all over the country as well. It's a big thing. And
I mean, to be fair,
every time,
yeah, oblivious of who
it's
wins.
It's not a Trump thing. It's a these just happen every 4 years.
And whatever the political leanings of any one organisation, whether or not it's a Democrat or Republican coming in, I mean, because some of these they organised them 4 years ago. I mean, it's not that it's something that you do after the election. It's just in the calendar and they organise it. And I suppose, and it will be relevant to one of the stories you're about to talk to, quite a lot of them are charity events.
Yes.
So I suppose it's a massive fundraising.
I think for the most part, they are charity events. There's certainly, I think all of them will have some sort of charity element to them, whether they're entirely to benefit a charity or kind of in part. But that's sort of, I mean, it has to be really. But it's sort of really, the thing is, like, if you've got a political organisation, whether that be, Republican, Democrat, or just bipartisan, which a lot of them are, you have a big party. And it doesn't matter who's getting in, just parties are nice.
And that's the interesting thing, that obviously all the stories that have been coming out, and as you say, this has been building up ever since the election, is if you play one of these events, whether it's the official event or one of the unofficial events, of which there are many more, as an artist, if you play one of these events, is that an endorsement of Trump? Is that an endorsement of the president? And I suppose, although, I mean, some of these stories actually relate to unofficial events. If it is in any way an endorsement of the president, that might be true of the official events. But if the unofficial events are just charity parties that happen because we've got a new president, then in what way is that endorsing Trump and his politics and his people? Well, that's very much what has been the news story about this, is if, as an artist, if you play one of these events, is that an endorsement for Trump? And then there are lots of artists who don't want to be, well, either they don't want to endorse Trump, or at the very least, they don't want to be seen to be endorsing Trump.
Yes, and I think that's been a problem for artists on this election than possibly any other, because there's a lot of artists who were booked or have been talked to or are playing these events who just kind of, as a matter of course, they get booked to play them every time, regardless of who the president is. I mean, I think they tend to go for a lot of kind of very American patriotic performers. There's a lot of country music, certainly in Trump's official party, but that's, you know, sort of like, you know, the big American, mostly of interest to Americans sort of artist.
Well, probably the sort of artist you book for your Independence Day gala.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I suppose, you know, some of the artists who have been criticised for either looking like they were going to play one of these events or possibly criticised one of those have said, well, they did it, you know, if it's a politics thing, and I suppose if you're on the left or you're liberal or you're sort of, and you have concerns about Trump, well, a lot of people played when George Bush was being inaugurated. Yeah. And it's not like, I mean, George Bush, what at the time, I mean, perhaps in hindsight, what were we all talking about? But seemed like quite a controversial candidate. And then on his first time round, there was the controversy around the allegations of vote rigging in Florida and all of that side. And of course, the second time round, you know, we were 2 years after the invasion on Iraq, and there was quite a lot of anger about his foreign policy. So you had a sort of right-leaning Republican president who was controversial amongst part of the artist community, and yet it didn't really feel... It might have done if people had played the official inauguration parties, but there didn't seem to be any controversy around playing one of the unofficial events, even though you had a president which in some parts of the artist community was a controversial figure.
Yes. But so what happened with this is obviously throughout the campaign, the controversy was Trump playing artists' songs at his rallies and then the artist saying, really would rather you didn't do that. And that happened a lot throughout the campaign. We reported, and you know, Neil Young and Rolling Stones and lots of people.
As we've discussed in the podcast, actually in copyright grounds, there's nothing you can do about it. But in that scenario, your music is actually being used alongside a overtly political event where Donald Trump is saying his nonsense political things.
Yes.
Rather than just being a party that happens to coincide with something.
But that was the running story, regardless of that. And then post-election, it was who is going to play his inauguration party, given that a lot of people have come out really anti-Trump throughout his campaign. And so they went a long time where they certainly seemed to be struggling to book anyone at all.
Well, there was one point, and also we talked about this last week because we just briefly mentioned some of the artists who had gone on record of saying they'd been invited to play and they refused, either in a comedy way or just in a straight way, saying, no, we're not going to do that. But there was a time when it looked like, I mean, certainly for the official events, they were really struggling to book talent, and Donald Trump was sort of saying, oh, well, who needs pop stars to celebrate? We're going to have lots of other great stuff going on. I don't know what he was planning, a tombola or maybe...
Meat raffle.
Yeah, something like that. But he was sort of saying, we don't need pop stars. But clearly, behind the scenes, they wanted some musical entertainment because they have continued to desperately try and find people to book. And indeed, in the end, they published a lineup, which, okay, for certainly those of us outside the US, most of them were like, who? But, I mean, you know, they went to the effort to book 15 people or however many people they've got playing the official event. So clearly they wanted some music happening during the party.
Yes, they've got two. They've got Toby Keith.
Yeah, heard of him.
The Piano Guys.
Nope.
Lee Greenwood, who he's sort of a stalwart of any political event because I think he wrote a song called God Bless America, and so it's easy to roll that out. Ravi Drums. Three Doors Down, who are playing their first gig in a very long time for Trump. Not to be confused with Third Eye Blind, who played a Republican event during the election and mocked all the Republicans.
With comedy effect.
That was a fun story. The Frontmen of Country, supergroup of country frontmen, as you might have guessed from the name.
Would have done.
John Voight, the actor, who was one of the few celebrities to really come out in favour of Trump during his campaign. And, of course, Donald Trump himself will be singing a few tunes. I think he's possibly just speaking. But there was Jennifer Holliday on that list initially, who is a Broadway singer. She was in Dreamgirls and various other things. She's been on Broadway for a long, long time in various musicals. And she was announced on the lineup, and then there was a bit of a kickback. She has a very big LGBT fan base, and lots of people said, how could you possibly perform for Donald Trump?
Bearing in mind, this was one of the official events.
This is the big official public event. Yeah. How could you perform for him, given his politics? And she put out a statement so they announced on Friday the lineup. On the Saturday, she put out a statement saying, I've pulled out, you're right, I really misjudged this, and I didn't take into account the politics, because she was saying, you know, I've performed for other presidents at inaugurations. I wasn't being political, I was just performing a thing to celebrate our country. But I recognise that it could be seen as my personal politics being in favour of Trump, which I don't think she went as far as saying that's not the case, but basically that's what she was saying.
Now, she is the only dropout. I sort of sensed when that announcement came through, Andy, who has already compared this to the infamous Bepop Live event that the Leave campaign attempted as part of the European referendum, you were hoping there would be dropout until basically they had to book Bucks Fizz.
Yeah, if Bucks Fizz, formerly known as Bucks Fizz,
exactly,
as we officially have to call them.
For legal reasons.
If they'd ended up performing, that would be great. I mean, I think at this stage, a week before the event, they did have one dropout, but I think most performers at that stage are going to be aware of what they're getting themselves in for. There have been various other people who've been put forward for the lineup since then. Apparently, there's talk of there being various surprises on the night. New York Daily News was reporting that former Motown singer Christette Michelle is going to perform, but she wanted it to be kept a secret because she was scared of a backlash, particularly after the Jennifer Holliday.
Well, that makes no sense, because there'll still be a backlash.
Well, there's going to be a backlash, yeah. Also, the secret's out now, so, yeah, never mind. One artist who didn't perform, who was touted and has performed for previous presidents, is Garth Brooks. He does a regular Facebook Live chat with fans where he answers questions and talks about things that he's doing. And in this video, one of his team says, like, you're going to have to talk about the inauguration. There's like 75% of the people commenting on this video are asking about the inauguration. And he basically said, oh, well, you know, I was asked about this by TMZ last year, and I said I hadn't been asked. And then I had a bit of discussion about it with the organisers. And in the end, I left it up to karma, which is a very weird thing to say. And then, oh, he had some tour dates booked, so couldn't do it. What a shame. Which some people took as not a good enough explanation.
Also, doesn't the tour start on Saturday?
Yeah, but
and the inauguration's on Friday. So that doesn't mean he couldn't have done it.
I know, but he's got to load his car up with his amp and stuff.
And do enough laundry for the whole of the tour.
But the thing you alluded to, which is one where I kind of feel sorry for the act involved.
Because this is an unofficial event, although a lot of the reporting sort of implied it was the official event.
Yeah, so this is it was a Bruce Springsteen tribute act called the B Street Band, who they've performed. They were performing at an unofficial event, a bipartisan event for the New Jersey State Society, and I think they've played that like three times before.
And they were booked like three years ago.
They were booked 3 years ago
before
to play this.
Trump was even on the agenda.
However, where this came from was New Jersey Democratic State Senator Ray Lesniak tweeted, shame on this band for playing Trump's inauguration, which is not exactly what's happening. But then that caused a big backlash and caused such controversy that the band ended up backing out because it all got on top of them a bit, I think.
I suppose the allegation was that given Bruce Springsteen's politics and his previous comments, it wasn't in the spirit of Springsteen for them to participate in this event.
But they were playing just an event that was surrounding the inauguration. It wasn't in support of Donald Trump per se, and then, you know, the band have said that, you know, they're not political at all. They don't really, like Bruce Springsteen, fair enough, he's got political opinions, but they don't necessarily have any of any note. And then, this senator afterwards, after they dropped out, he was like, yeah, good, that's really good they've done that. I hope they'll play my inauguration like they played my birthday party once. Like, weird thing to say. Also, no, I don't think that's going to happen. Even in the unlikely event that you become president, I'm pretty sure they're not going to play for you.
Given you emotionally blackmailed them into giving up a charity gig. But there you go.
Another unofficial event is going to be headlined by Audioslave, who are reforming after 11 years. But they're playing an anti-Trump event.
Yeah, I guess if you know anything about the politics of that outfit, or of course Rage Against Machine.
And Prophets of Rage.
Which are all these different projects, you would think it would be odd even playing an unofficial event that was bipartisan. But yes, this is an official anti-Trump event to coincide with the inauguration. So an opportunity for all those artists who desperately didn't want to perform, but sort of did want to perform. It means they can get on stage and be angry.
We mentioned how, you know, they'd been struggling to get big name acts, and that had become a big thing. And then they sort of, Trump and the Inauguration Committee had been trying to diffuse that by saying, oh, we don't want big name acts, we want patriotic American acts. Or we don't want any acts at all, which was the line at one point. But there's this thing that's clearly been leaked to TMZ as an attempt to save face on this. And sort of came out looking a bit desperate. So this the story was, we were trying to book this legendary group, in inverted commas, who they're inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but they were charging too much, and this is a charity event, and so we didn't want to, you know, they wouldn't drop their fee, so it's the artist who's to blame.
Yeah, throw it back to the rock stars.
But they didn't name the rock stars. Yeah. So
it wasn't that no rock stars would play, it was just that they were all greedy and they were asking for too much money, and we were worried about the little people who will benefit from the... Because the profits go to charity, don't they? So, having said that, I mean, I've not investigated this enough. This is my understanding that lots of people donate money to allow these events to happen, and then the profits go to charity.
Yeah.
And how much was it?
They'd received donations of over 90 million.
So people donate 90 million so these events can happen, and then the profits go to charity. Why don't they just give the 90 million to charity and then be done with it?
Because parties are nice.
So I'm not sure doing the whole, well, we put the charity's interest first. Like, would you put the charity's interest first, you'd cancel all the events and just hand over the 90 million. So I'm not sure that. Even if we believe that there genuinely was a massive legendary rock band who wanted to play, but they were greedy and they didn't want to take the money away from charity, I'm not sure that they have the right to be high and mighty about their charitable credentials.
One last story about the inauguration this week, which you could doubt if you want to. I think there's a certain amount of doubt in the validity of this story. But it's another New York Daily News story.
It is.
They reported that ticket touts are struggling to sell tickets to the big official party. Now, for one thing, those tickets are free to start with. But I think they were implying that all those tickets were gone, and now ticket touts are buying them up at inflated prices and trying to sell them on at even more inflated prices. And they had a guy on.
Well, you were right, because you were right to sort of open this bit being a bit dubious. Because it was one of those stories that had a really bold headline. Of, oh, that's really interesting. That's a really funny story. But then when you actually start reading the story, it wasn't ticket touts are having trouble.
It was one guy who'd bought two tickets.
And then it's like. And he's not really a ticket tout. He's just a guy who very occasionally sells tickets on StubHub.
Yeah.
So not quite as good as a story as the headline promised.
But yeah, it's when he bought two tickets for the inauguration off Craigslist. I think he paid $200 per ticket, and he was trying to sell them for $700, and he wasn't able to get shot at them. And then he was saying, oh, it looks like I'll just end up having to go myself. Although the New York Daily News did note that he was selling the tickets at a much higher price than any other touts.
Yeah, there were other tickets being touted a lot. So, didn't at one point say he'd put them on the pin board at work to try and give them away and no one would take them? But
so, although you have to pour some scorn on that story.
It's a funny story
the,
anyway.
The headline is amusing.
Yeah, so let's ignore all the facts, which I think is in the spirit
of Donald Trump, which should entirely ignore the facts.
Ignore all the facts of that story and just hone in on the amusing headline, which is, I sort of feel, in one observation, sort of how we got to this point in history, that we are now in an age where people don't read the stories and delve into the facts. Yeah, we are in a world led by people who navigate what's happening by deliberately misleading headlines, and then they don't read the story that's linking to.
Yeah.
So we're going to embrace that here at CMU, and from this point onwards, we're just going to report on stories devoid of fact or substance, but which have amusing headlines.
In the spirit of how you just finished that last section, let's look at the news in brief.
Yes.
Where we just go through the headlines and don't give any real detail.
Let's do lots of misleading bullet points without explaining what's going on behind the scenes.
These are all very factual headlines.
They are. All facts, everybody.
So Sony Entertainment CEO Michael Lynton has confirmed that he's leaving the company, as previously discussed on the podcast before Christmas.
And last time we discussed it, it was rampant rumour.
Yeah.
Now it's fact.
Yeah.
So actually, we've done the opposite of what we said we were going to do. We've taken rampant rumour from 2016 and we've turned it into fact.
There's still a large part of that story that remains rumour.
There is speculation, as we discussed on the podcast prior to Christmas, when the rumour was going round that Michael Lynton, who ran the entertainment bits. The entertainment bit of Sony is based out of the US, and basically it owns the global TV, movie and music Sony companies.
Yeah.
Okay, so everything that happens outside of Japan, so Sony Pictures, the Sony TV company, and Sony Music and Sony ATV, the aforementioned Sony ATV. Although Michael Lynton himself was mainly hands-on with the movies and the TV,
yeah.
Although the music companies reported into him. So in terms of the hierarchy, music sits underneath him. When the rumours were going round that he was leaving, and it turns out he is going to Snapchat, which was one of the things that was rumoured prior to Christmas, because he was an early investor in Snapchat. So he's going to go and do that full time. But the speculation there was then, and which continues, is when he leaves, and he's going to stick around for another 6 months while they find a replacement.
Yeah.
But the speculation is that this is an opportunity for Sony to restructure their entertainment division, the global stuff that's based in the US. And the rumour, which was strongly denied by Sony in December, so we'll see now whether it does happen, now we know that Lynton's leaving, is to put the movies and the TV company into interactive entertainment, so put it alongside all the gaming and the PlayStation stuff. They deny that's going to happen, but if it does happen, well, what does that mean for music? And there seems to be a consensus that music might be put in its own division, so it won't sit alongside movies or TVs or gaming or anything, it'll be in its own little division. And then there are two ways that you can extend that if you want more gossip. One is that this is an opportunity to bring the Sony Record Company and the Sony Publishing Company closer together now that Sony owns Sony ATV outright, so more closely integrate publishing and recordings. The other conspiracy theory, if you prefer, is once music sits on its own within the business, does that make it easier to sell? There's been speculation for years now that Sony wants to offload its movie company or its music company. They always deny it, and to be fair, actually, if you look at the wider Sony business, I mean, okay, music and movies might have had a few wobbly years, but compared to some of the other Sony businesses, they've been doing really well. So I don't sense myself that they are going to sell it off. But I suppose if it was sitting there as its own unit on its own, it might be easier to sell it off.
It would make it easier to do that.
So look at that. We took a fact and then we wildly speculated.
Pandora, celebrating its big expansion plans, is axing 7% of its workforce.
So the publicly listed Pandora company, its share price is all over the place at the moment. I mean, in some ways, that's because of speculation it's going to be bought. Lots of people feel that Pandora, given that it's moving into on-demand streaming, it's trying to diversify, it would be much better off if it was a private company or a subsidiary of a bigger company rather than being directly listed on the stock exchange where you've constantly got investors scrutinising you and commenting on you. And so there's lots of gossip about, well, Sirius seems to be the company that is sort of interested. Can they afford it at the current price? Probably not. But whenever there's lots of takeover speculation, it means your share price is constantly wobbling because, oh, they're going to buy, share price goes up. Oh, no, they're not interested, share price goes down, and so on and so forth. But wobbly share price means ever more scrutiny of Pandora's finances. Will this diversifying into sort of ticketing and fully on-demand streaming, will that help them go into profit? Perhaps it will, perhaps it won't. But, I mean, certainly cutting costs is going to appeal to investors on Wall Street and potentially to potential buyers. Even if the asking price seems very high, if the subsequent running costs are less, it might make it more attractive to a Sirius or whoever. But not good news for the about, we think, 150 people who will be phased out at Pandora in the coming months.
Alanis Morissette's former business manager has admitted to stealing from her almost $5 million.
Which is a lot of money.
It is a lot of money to not notice. In fact, she didn't notice until she got a new business manager who then audited the accounts and went, well, where's this $5 million?
I mean, on one level, I mean, it's horrible and it's a happy ending because the company that this guy worked for has now paid Alanis Morissette back.
And several other people who had money stolen from them. Not as much money, but this person stole $7 million in total. So the bulk of it was Alanis Morissette's money.
So Alanis has got her money back and that's good. And they're now suing him and all of that. Although you've got to have quite a lot of money to not notice $5 million have gone missing.
And it's only now that he's come forward and admitted the theft. Previously, his defence was that he'd invested in an illegal marijuana growing operation, I think at the request of Alanis Morissette was his story. And because it was an illegal operation, they didn't have the paperwork, and that was why there was no paperwork this money had gone.
That's why there's no receipts for this money. But he has now admitted to the crime. His lawyers are trying to get a plea deal. He's definitely going to jail because that's some serious embezzlement.
Yes, although I think it was looking at 23 years and now it might be four.
Well, they're trying to negotiate it down with a plea deal now that he's admitted, and the plea deal being a thing that happens in sort of American criminal cases.
And finally, Michael Bublé has pulled out of hosting this year's Brit Awards. He cancelled all of his professional engagements last November after his son was diagnosed with leukaemia. But the Brit Awards job, which is obviously in February, hung in the balance a bit. He still wanted to do it, I think.
And well, no, I mean,
they were hoping that he'd be kind of back in work mode by then.
I mean, it seemed at the time, given that actually the Brits weren't that far away and given, you know, the serious nature of the reason he was stepping down, you sort of felt, I don't see he's going to be hosting it. But apparently the Brit Award organisers had been very good to him in saying, well, we would still leave you to do it, so you just take as long as you need before you confirm. But obviously we're now getting close enough to the event that presumably he had to make a decision. So yes, he has. Well, having said that, we say he has confirmed. As we record this, this is still based on tabloid reportage. So we're still waiting for the official remark on this. But it seems quite likely. And then apparently various other people have been either sounded out or have put themselves forward.
Yeah, so it's entirely possible by the time this goes out we've actually got a replacement for him.
Or it's been confirmed that this is tabloid nonsense.
Given that that hasn't happened and it's been fairly widely reported now, I think that it's definitely happening that they're going to have to replace him. But yes, who that will be could be Anton Deck back again for a third year in the row. Let's hope not.
Let's hope not.
Could be James Corden back for
he's too big now.
700th time.
He's too big.
Doing it. No, he's got his US talk show.
He's a superstar
how
now.
How did that happen? We haven't got time to talk about that now.
I don't know how it happened. Why are people so... No, let's not go on a rant about this Carpool karaoke nonsense. Why are people more excited about that? You know, one of the Jimmies, I get all the Jimmies confused who do late night shows. The one who has the Roots as his house band.
Kimmel.
That's not Kimmel, it's the other one.
Is it?
I think it's the other one. Anyway, whichever Jimmy it is who does stuff with the Roots. When he does that stuff with the Roots where they play on children's instruments, they're really good.
Yeah.
Why aren't people excited about
it?
I suppose it's sort of a bit cliche now because he's been doing it
but
for a
while. But someone driving a car.
but not on the level of the James Corden nonsense that apparently is now becoming... I mean, I can see there being a movie by the end of the year. Don't understand it. But anyway...
Well, it has an Apple option. I'm not going to do
there is an Apple thing, yeah. But the good news is James Corden's now too big to do the Brits, so it's not going to be Corden. So imagine if they had got Amstel to do it. I fell into a YouTube hole of watching Amstel-era Pop World interviews.
Again, this happens
It happens to me frequently. Not frequently, about once a year.
That's more frequent than most people.
I can't even quite remember how it happened. But they were golden days for pop TV.
They really were.
And, I mean, he's way beyond that now. He's not interested. But imagine if they got him to host the Brits back in the day. How awesome that would have been. So, who knows? By this time next week, I suspect we'll know who the replacement is because it is getting quite close
now. Getting very close.
Robbie is going to sing. Perhaps Robbie Williams could host it.
Well, he was one of the people that was being touted. So by the BBC, they did a long list of who it could be.
Except that they announced today that he was performing, so surely they would have announced that
perform,
too.
Well, you never know. Maybe they're still negotiating.
Anyway. Perhaps there's a dispute on what coffee to serve backstage, because his Brits Icon was sponsored by a coffee company, wasn't it?
It was, yes.
So perhaps it's all the coffee arrangements are still to be agreed, and they might yet get Robbie to host.
Anyway, if you want to read about any of those stories... Not James Corden, but the bulk of those stories we just discussed in more detail. You can go to completemusicupdate.com/podcast. You'll find the show notes of this show and you'll find links to all of those stories in there. Okay, lastly now, we're going to answer one of your questions again.
So yes, as we discussed on last week's podcast, new part of the... programme? Can we call it a programme?
Yes.
I don't want to say podcast twice in a sentence. That's the only reason I'm asking. Where we're answering your questions. So either if you come to a CMU event, so one of the Insights events or the CMU DIY events, and there's a question that you would like to have answered that possibly isn't relevant to what's being discussed at that event, or is, either or, then you can come to me afterwards and tell me the question and then we'll answer it here on the podcast. Or if you can't be bothered coming to one of our events, I don't know why we're being nice to people who can't be bothered to come to one of our events.
Maybe they hurt their leg.
Maybe they hurt their leg. Or maybe they're agoraphobic. If you're agoraphobic, then you can email us your question and we will answer some of those from email. The email address being?
cmupodcast@unlimitedmedia.co.uk.
But this week does come from the event. So I hosted one of our seminars for the guys at IMRO in Ireland, in Dublin this week. It was all about social and digital stuff. Lots of conversations about Snapchat. I had lots of things to say about Snapchat, but there were a couple of people in the room who had lots to say about Snapchat. So I'm going to interview. I'm currently working on a CMU Trends article all about how to use Snapchat in music. And there were a couple of DIY artists there who seem to have cracked it. So look out for that article if you're a premium subscriber. But that's not what we're here to talk about today.
No, we're going to talk about the old people's social network, Facebook. Because the question we've got this week, and who's the name of the person you failed to get.
But several people asked.
Okay.
I wasn't
you could have got all of their
every
names.
Time I could have done.
Still, anonymous people ask, should artists put their videos on Facebook as well as YouTube?
So we all know that Facebook very much shifted into video in the last couple of years. When you're scrolling down your Facebook feed, every other post these days seems to be videos. And so that's a question for artists. They're all sort of in the habit of uploading videos to YouTube and then putting sort of photos and updates on the other social networks. So should you now be putting your videos up on Facebook?
Especially as I think people have probably noticed, but may not have done, but various big name artists recently, like in the last few months particularly, have done video premieres on Facebook rather than YouTube. And so there may be reasons why that's a good thing for big name artists to do, but as artists in a general sense of all sizes, should they be following suit?
And then there are different elements to that, which is, should you be putting videos on both? Should you be putting different versions of the videos on each? Should you be putting it, as you say, on Facebook first before YouTube or the other way around, and all of this? Now, as with all these things, there is no answer for everybody. It's an element of working it out for yourself. But I suppose there are two components to this. So there's a licensing component and there is a marketing component. So let's start with the licensing component first, which is to say, as it stands, Facebook doesn't have any licensing deals in place with any record companies or any music publishers or any collecting societies, let alone DIY artists. So even if ads were to roll before or after or in between your videos, as happens on the Facebook app, you're not going to get a cut of that money. Whereas obviously on YouTube, for all the music industry hates YouTube, let's not forget, if an ad rolls before your video, providing they don't get skipped or little banner ads pop up within the video, if YouTube make money out of advertising around your content, then they will share that with you. They'll give you 55% of the money. The publishing bit will get paid out of their 45% through their licensing deals with the collecting societies or the publishers. Providing you are a content partner of YouTube, you can share in the money. Now, it's 55% of a tiny sum of money, and you only earn if adverts are played. So for most people, it's it's a relatively small sum of money. But if you happen to get a viral hit and then, you know, hundreds of thousands of views, actually it becomes pretty decent money having. And so you can have that on YouTube. You can't have it on Facebook.
I mean, as an aside, it's sort of an interesting thing. That's like the music industry, as we know from talking about it ad nauseum on this podcast, is very much knives out for YouTube at the moment. Saying it doesn't pay enough. This is all, you know, you're doing it all wrong. We need to be paid more. And YouTube's got to the point it got to because the music industry for quite a long time saw YouTube as just, oh, it's just a marketing platform and we make a little bit of money and that's fine. And then it's built up to something kind of bigger and more powerful where the music industry is now going, oh, I'm not sure about that. That doesn't seem right. But then on Facebook, there are more big artists putting their videos on Facebook. They're doing the same thing.
Well, of course they are. Everything goes round in circles. So yes, if you are earning money from your videos being played on YouTube and then people switch over and they start playing on Facebook, then you're not going to earn any money. Now, behind the scenes, we know Facebook launched their sort of equivalent of the Content ID system, their content manager system, and behind the scenes, talks are ongoing. And at some point, licensing deals similar to those that YouTube have should roll out. Although, as is always the way of those things, they'll initially roll out with the majors and then with the indies through Merlin. And it will, I mean, I don't know how quickly the distributors of this world, who's the tune calls of this world, will get that element to it. But I mean, usually the superstars and the majors get access to that before everybody else does. And anyway, as it currently stands, it's not available at all. So if you are making money out of YouTube, well, that's a decision to make. If people are now watching your content on Facebook, that's lost money. And I think that's why when Facebook video first started to gain momentum, what a lot of artists were doing is they were putting trailer videos on Facebook, the messaging being go over to YouTube to watch this video in full and trying to push people to the YouTube page where they might bring in some money. There's also the side licensing issue, which is if you're doing a cover version, so you don't own the song copyright, you only own the recording copyright, then a publisher might block your content. Now, they could do that on YouTube, but they're much more likely on YouTube to monetize the content. Yeah. To say, we won't block it, we'll just take our publishing royalties, our cut of the ad income. They can't do that on Facebook. So either they say, oh, life's too short, can't be bothered. But there are some publishers now who are getting quite prolific at going into the Facebook system and blocking songs that they see other people doing. So there might be the issue around cover versions as well. So you might find if you put your content up on Facebook and YouTube, it's much more likely to get blocked on Facebook if it's a cover. So those are the licensing elements of this.
But over on the marketing side, as you will know, if you're a Facebook user, Facebook has really been building up the video side of its business, and you're more likely to see videos in your feed than, you know, ever before. And it's all, you know, processed by an algorithm to show your video to people who are most likely to be interested in it. So that has a big opportunity for you as an artist, particularly an emerging artist, if you, like you say, you happen to get a bit of a viral hit going.
No, and I think there's various elements to that, which is firstly, I think generally the research shows, that's all common sense, as you scroll down your Facebook feed, particularly on mobile, the video tends to stand out. Also, obviously, if you put something on your Facebook artist profile and you have 1,000 fans on Facebook, not every one of those 1,000 fans are getting your post in their feed because yeah. Facebook filters. And actually, a relatively small minority are probably seeing your content unless you pay Facebook some money. However, because Facebook are so obsessed about we're going to be a video platform, generally speaking, your video content is much more likely to organically appear in a user's feed than any other sort of content is, and certainly text content.
So that's definitely a bonus for video on Facebook. Although it's worth noting that by default on Facebook, video is muted, which is why you'll notice most videos come with subtitles,
which
is a very small number of people will ever unmute a video. So that presents a problem for music videos.
I mean, I would say for a new artist, you should be putting videos on both, even though there are the licensing. I mean, if it's a cover version, maybe not, but if it's your own music, put it on both, even though there are the licensing issues. But yes, is it the same video? And should you be putting a different video on Facebook? Partly because you might want to put a smaller version and then send people to YouTube for the full version, which certainly was the norm a year ago when Facebook video was first gaining off. But also there is the idea, yeah, in order to engage on Facebook, you probably need some text in the video, which is enough to make people go, oh, I'm interested in this. Right, I'm going to click what I need to click to make the sound come through. So you, even just for engagement reasons, you might need a different bit of content on Facebook. And then as with all social media things, and I said this yesterday at the session as we talked through Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and Snapchat and YouTube and SoundCloud and all of these, which is all of these services are free to use to an extent, but there are only so many hours in the day. And sort of as an artist, you need to make a decision. Where are you going to focus your time? Where are you going to put in the most effort? And it may simply be that you just don't have the time or the resource to be editing all these different versions of these videos. And so that's almost the hardest bit. Understanding how to use the systems is a bit of work, but actually the hardest decision as an artist to make, and it's true of anybody running a business, is there's only so many hours in the day, which am I going to prioritise? And then that constant nagging feeling at the end of every day, week, month, I didn't prioritise the right things. I put all my effort into that and I should have put my effort into that. That's life. But as an artist, you need to get your head around that. And obviously, once you've got management and label, A, they bring more resource to the table, but also they will help you with those decisions. So I'm not sure that even answers the question.
But I hope it was of some help to someone. If you have a question that you would like us to attempt to answer, but anything music related, email it over to cmupodcast@unlimitedmedia.co.uk and we'll see what we can do.
CMU DIY events are back. The Red Bull Studios thing that we do with Urban Development every month. We had a little break over the autumn. We're back on Tuesday at the Red Bull Studios because it's the first one, real beginner's guide session. So if you've never been to one of these sessions before, do come along. If you go to cmudiy.com, you can find a link through to where you can get your tickets from Urban Development for that. But if you come to that, bring some questions.
Yeah.
And we'll answer them on the podcast.
Well, that brings us to the end of our podcast. I'll tell you a good podcast. Not that this isn't a good podcast. It is a good podcast. Let me tell you that. But here's another good podcast. It's Soundtracking, which is Edith Bowman's relatively new podcast where she talks to film directors about the music in their films, which, as someone who is interested in music and films, is right up my street. She recently interviewed John Michael McDonough, who directed War on Everyone and The Guard and Calvary, about the music in his films, and I think that was possibly the best episode of it yet. He was very interesting, very thoughtful about how he uses music to work with his visual filmmaking.
And if you're just listening now, we've bigged up your podcast. The etiquette is you big up our podcast. I'm still looking forward to the song Matt Willis is writing about our podcast after we bigged up.
I'm sure he's spending some time on that.
Bigged up the Scroobius Pip podcast with him on it last week.
But you see, that's a recommendation I have for you. Now, why don't you recommend our podcast to someone else? Keep it going in a chain.
He's now talking to you, the listener, not Edith Bowman.
Well, both.
Both.
Edith Bowman is welcome to recommend our podcast to whoever she wants. You also, the listener, just recommend it to someone if you like it, which I assume you do, because you've listened this far. It was very long this week. But we are finished now, so I just have to do the final credits. This podcast was presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It was produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
And Bohemian Rhapsody was very good. I'll share it with you.
Thanks.